her arrival in the UK, Tulip made clear her need for physical exercise. The RAF fighter plane had been cramped. The drive to Camp 4 had made her feel like a prisoner. Confinement of any sort was unbearable to her, etc. Since the Camp 4 paths are not suitable for cycling, she would run. Having obtained her shoe size, Harper went into Salisbury for a pair of plimsolls, and for the next 3 mornings, Tulip and Avon, Anna, a keen exercise person, jogged the perimeter paths together before breakfast, Tulip taking with her a light shoulder bag for any fossil or rare stone that might interest Gustav. Borrowing the Russian jargon, she called it her perhaps bag. The estate also offers a small gymnasium which, when other means failed, provided Tulip with temporary relief from her evident stress. Regardless of the hour, Millie McCraig never failed to accompany her to the gymnasium. Tulip's normal practice was to stand ready-dressed at the French window of her living room at 0600 hours and wait for Avon to appear. However, on this particular morning, Tulip was not standing at her window. Avon therefore entered the guest suite from the garden side, calling out her name, rattling the bathroom door, and, on receiving no response, opening it in vain. Avon then inquired of McCraig over the interconnecting phone where Tulip was to be found, but McCraig was unable to enlighten her. By now seriously concerned, Avon then set off at a fast pace along the perimeter path. As a precaution, McCraig, meanwhile, alerted Harper and Lowe that our guest had gone runabout, and the two security guards at once began quartering the estate. 4. Discovery of Tulip. Personal statement by J. Avon. Entered from the eastern side, the circuit path of the estate rises steeply for some 20 yards and plateaus out for about a quarter of a mile before turning north and descending into a marshy dell, crossed by a wooden footbridge leading in turn to an ascending wooden staircase of 9 steps, the upper steps being partly overshadowed by a spreading chestnut tree. On turning north and beginning to descend to the dell, I caught sight of Tulip hanging by the neck from a low branch of the chestnut, eyes open and hands to her sides. It is my memory that the clearance between her feet and the nearest wooden step was no more than 12 inches. The noose around her neck was so thin that at first sight she appeared to be floating in thin air. I am a woman of 42. I must emphasize that I have recorded these impressions as they remain in my mind today. I am service-trained and have experience of operational emergency. It is therefore humbling to confess that my only impulse on seeing Tulip hanging from a tree was to run back to the house as fast as possible and summon help rather than attempt to cut her down and resuscitate her. I deeply regret this lapse of operational composure, although I am now assured categorically that Tulip had been dead for at least 6 hours when I found her, which is a major relief to me, plus the fact that I had no knife, and the rope was out of my reach. Supplementary report by Millie McCraig, safe housekeeper, Camp 4, career officer grade 2, on the care, maintenance and suicide of subsource Tulip, copy to George Smiley, H. Covert, only. Millie as I knew her then, bride of the service, devout daughter of a minister of the Free Presbyterian Church, climbs the Cairngorms, rides to hounds and has a history of dangerous places. Lost her brother to the war, her father to cancer, and her heart, according to rumour, to a married older man who loved honour more. There were tongues that said man in the case was George, though nothing I ever saw between them led me to believe it. But woe betide any of us young bloods who tried to lay a finger on her, for Millie would have none of us. 1. Disappearance of Tulip. Having been informed by Jeanette Avon at 0610 hours that Tulip had set out for a morning run on her own, I immediately requested security, Harper and Law, to institute a search of the estate, concentrating on the perimeter path, which I understood from Avon to be Tulip's preferred route. As a precaution, I then undertook an inspection of the guest suite and established that her tracksuit and running shoes were still in her wardrobe. The French day clothes and underclothes which she had been issued in Prague, on the other hand, were not. Although she had neither identity papers nor money in her possession, Her handbag, which I had earlier established contained nothing beyond personal necessities, was also missing. The situation being beyond the competence of Covert, and H. Covert being absent on urgent duty in Berlin, I took the executive decision to call the duty officer at joint steering and request him to inform police liaison that an escaped mental patient answering Tulip's description was at large in the vicinity, that she was non-violent, spoke no English, and was undergoing psychiatric treatment. If found, she should be returned to this institute. I then called Dr. Meadows at his consulting rooms in Harley Street and left word with his secretary that he should please return ASAP to Camp 4 to be told that, having received word from HO, he was already on his way. 2. Discovery of an unauthorized intruder at Camp 4. I had scarcely completed these calls when I received word from Harper over the Camp 4 internal intercommunication system advising me that, in the course of his search for Tulip, he had discovered, at a wooded point close to the eastern perimeter, an injured person, male, apparently an intruder, who, having made his way through a freshly cut hole at a point close to the bypass, had stepped on and activated an ancient snare, partly overgrown and presumably left there by a poacher in the days before the circus acquired the premises. The said snare, an illegal and antiquated device consisting of rusted dragon's teeth, still sprung. The intruder, according to Harper, had caught his left leg in the mechanism and, by thrashing about, entangled himself further. He spoke good English, but with a foreign accent, and insisted that, on seeing the hole in the fence, he had climbed through it in order to perform a natural function. He also explained that he was a passionate birdwatcher. With the arrival of Lowe, the two men between them had released the intruder, whereupon he had punched Lowe in the stomach, then head-butted Harper in the face. After a further struggle, the two men had pacified the intruder and delivered him to the stoop, which lay conveniently close. He was now confined in the holding cell, submarine, with a temporary dressing to his left leg. In accordance with standing security procedure, Harper had reported the incident, providing as full a description as possible of the intruder directly to HO Internal Security and to H. Covert, now on his way back from Berlin. On my inquiring of Harper whether he or Lowe had meanwhile sighted the missing Tulip, he replied that the intruder had temporarily diverted them from their search, which they would immediately resume. 3. News of Tulip's death. It was approximately at this point of time that Jeanette Avon appeared at the porch of the main house in a distraught condition to announce that she had seen Tulip hanging by the neck from a tree, presumably dead, at point 217 on the estate map. I immediately passed this information to Harper and Lowe, and, having confirmed that their intruder was immobilized, instructed them to proceed with all speed to point 217 and apply necessary assistance. I then sounded a red alert requiring all resident support staff to assemble immediately in the main house. This included the two cooks, one driver, one maintenance man, two cleaners and two laundrymen. See list at Appendix A. I informed them that a dead body had been found on the estate and that they should all remain in the main house until further notice. I did not consider it necessary to inform them that an unauthorized intruder had also been found. Fortunately, at this juncture, Dr. Meadows appeared, having driven himself at high speed in his Bentley car. He and I at once set out along the eastern perimeter path in the direction of point 217. We arrived to find Tulip cut down and clearly dead, lying on the ground with a ligature in place around her neck, and Harper and Lowe standing watch over her. Harper, bleeding from the face, having been headbutted by the intruder, was minded to summon the police, Lowe, an ambulance. In the event, I advised that neither should be summoned without the approval of H. Covert, who was on his way to Camp 4. Dr. Meadows, after a preliminary examination of the body, was of a similar opinion. I accordingly instructed Harper and Lowe to return to the stoop, contact nobody, await further orders, and on no account attempt to engage their prisoner in conversation. Once they had departed the scene, Dr. Meadows confided to me that Tulip had been dead for several hours before discovery. While Dr. Meadows continued his examination of the dead woman, I took note of her attire, which consisted of her French twinset, pleated skirt, and court shoes. The pockets of the twinset jacket were empty, except for two used paper tissues. Tulip had been complaining of a slight cold. Her perhaps bag was stuffed with her remaining French underclothes. Our instructions, which by now were being relayed non-stop from head office over the Camp 4 intercom, were to transfer the body immediately to the stoop. I therefore summoned Harper and Lowe to act as stretcher party. This was promptly done, despite the fact that Harper was by now bleeding profusely from his wound. Together with Dr. Meadows, I returned to the main house. To her credit, Avon had collected herself and was distributing tea and biscuits to the staff and generally enlivening them. The head office crisis party under H. Covert was now expected to arrive by mid-afternoon. Meantime, all but Harper and Lowe were to remain in the main house while Dr. Meadows cleaned Harper's facial contusions and attended the injured intruder, now incarcerated in the submarine. A discussion, meanwhile, took place among those confined to the main house. Jeanette Avon insisted on counting herself the person most responsible for Tulip's suicide, but I took it upon myself to contradict this suggestion. Tulip was clinically depressed. Her sense of guilt and longing for Gustav were unbearable. She had destroyed the life of her sister Lottie. Suicide was probably in her mind by the time she arrived in Prague, and certainly by the time she reached Camp 4. She had made her choices and paid the ultimate price. And now enter George, bearing false messages. 4. Arrival of H. Covert, Smiley, and Inspector Mendel. H. Covert, Smiley, arrived at 1555 hours accompanied by Inspector Retired Oliver Mendel, a covert occasional. Dr. Meadows and I immediately escorted them to the stoop. I then returned to the main house where Ingeborg Lugg and Jeanette Avon together continued to soothe the agitations of the assembled staff. It was another 2 hours before Mr. Smiley returned from the stoop accompanied by Inspector Mendel. Calling the staff together, Mr. Smiley offered his personal condolences together with the assurance that subsource Tulip had only herself to blame for her death, and nobody in Camp 4 had cause to reproach themselves. Evening was now coming on. With the shuttle bus waiting in the forecourt and many of the team anxious to get home to Salisbury, H. Covert took a moment to put their minds at rest regarding the discovery of a mystery intruder, of whom some might have heard. With Inspector Mendel smiling reassurance beside him, he confessed that he was about to blab to the team a secret that they would never normally share, but in the circumstances he had decided that they deserved nothing less than full disclosure. The mystery intruder was no mystery, he explained. He was a valued member of an elite and little-known section of our sister service, MI5, tasked to penetrate by lawful and unlawful means the defences of our country's most sensitive and secret facilities. As it happened, he was also a personal and professional friend of Inspector Mendel here. Laughter. It was in the nature of such live exercises that the facility targeted should not be informed, and the fact that the exercise had been scheduled for the same day that Tulip had elected to do away with herself was no more than the act of a malign providence, to use Smiley's words. The same providence had guided the intruder's feet into the deer trap. Laughter. Harper and Lowe had acquitted themselves nobly. Both had had the situation explained to them and ruefully accepted it, even if they felt, understandably, that our friend had somewhat overdone his violent reaction. H. Covert, to more laughter. And for our further disinformation, H. Covert further confided to the gathering that the intruder, who was in fact no foreigner but an honest-to-God all-British native of Clapham, was already on his way to casualty in Salisbury, where he would receive a tetanus injection and have his injuries attended to. Inspector Mendel would be visiting his old friend shortly and taking him a bottle of whisky with the compliments of Camp 4. Applause. It's the Bunny and Laura show again. No Leonard. Bunny leads. Laura listens skeptically. So you compiled your report, in tedious detail if I may say so, You took all available evidence and then some. You sent an advance copy to Joint Steering and then you stole the same copy back from Circus Archives. Does that about sum it up? No, it doesn't. Then why is your report lodged here in the stables among a whole lot of papers that you did steal? Because it never went out on submission. To anyone. None of it, not even a shortened form, the Treasury Committee decided not to meet. You're talking about the so-called Committee of the Three Wise Men, I take it, of whom the circus lived in supposed dread. It was chaired by Oliver Lacon. Lacon concluded after much soul-searching that a report served no useful purpose, even in shortened form. On the grounds? That an inquiry into the suicide of a woman who had not landed in the United Kingdom was not a valid use of taxpayers' money. Was Lacon, by any conceivable chance, prompted in this decision by George Smiley? How should I know? Easily, I'd have thought. If it was your arse among others that Smiley was protecting, if, for instance, taking a purely hypothetical case at random, we assumed Tulip hanged herself on your account, was there perhaps a particular element or episode of the report that Smiley considered too disturbing for Treasury's tender ears? For Joint's tender ears, conceivably. Not Treasury's. Joint was already much too deep into the Mayflower operation for George's comfort. He may have thought that an inquiry would open the door even wider and advised Lacon accordingly. That's only my guess. You don't think by any chance that the real reason the inquiry was binned was that Tulip wasn't the cooperative defector she's painted to be, not at least by your arse-kissing report, and paid the price? What price? What on earth are you talking about? She was a woman of great determination, we know that. She was also, when she wished to be, a harridan. And she wanted her child back. I'm suggesting she refused to cooperate with the interrogation team until her son was returned to her, and her interrogators took a dim view of that, and their report, your report, was a fudge, cobbled together on Smiley's orders. And Camp 4, since scrapped, boasted, as we know, a special confinement cell for people like her. It was dubbed the submarine. It was used for what these days we are pleased to call enhanced interrogation, and it was the preserve of a couple of rather perverted security guards not known for their gentle ways. I'm suggesting she had the benefit of their attentions. You look shocked. Have I touched a nerve? It took me a moment to get there. Tulip wasn't interrogated, for Christ's sake. She was in the process of being debriefed, humanely and decently, by professional people who liked her and were grateful to her and understood a defector's tantrums. So laugh this one off, Bunny suggests. We have another letter before action, another potential litigant if the case comes to law. One Gustav Quince, son of Doris. Apparently, but not certainly, at the instigation of Christoph Limas, has added his name to those who are intent on suing the shit out of this service. We, this service, largely in the person of yourself, seduced his dear mother, blackmailed her into spying for us, smuggled her out of the country against her will, tortured her to hell and back, thereby causing her to hang herself from the nearest tree. True? Not true? I thought he'd finished, but he hadn't. And since these allegations, being dignified by the passage of time, cannot be suppressed by the draconian legislation that has been available to us in more recent cases of the same nature, there's a good chance that the all-party group, and or any subsequent litigation, will be used to pry into matters of considerably more relevance to us today. You seem amused. Amused. Perhaps I was. Gustav, I was thinking, well done you. You've decided to collect your due after all, even if you've come to the wrong address for it. I've ridden across France and Germany at breakneck speed through driving rain. I'm standing at Alex's graveside. The same rain sweeps the little cemetery in East Berlin. I am wearing my motorcycle leathers, but out of respect for Alex, I've removed my helmet and the rain is pouring down my bare face, as we silently exchange banalities. The elderly sacristan, or whatever he is, ushers me into his cabin and shows me the condolence book with Christoph's name among the mourners. And perhaps that was the point d'appui, the spur. First to Christoph, then to the carrot-haired Gustav with the buckwheat grin, who had sung his patriotic songs to me, and then to Alec. The same boy who from the day of his mother's death I had secretly, if only notionally, taken into my care, picturing him first in some gruesome East German borstel for children of the disgraced, then tossed out into an uncaring world. Secretly, too, I had from time to time brazenly transgressed standing circus regulations, tracking him through the archives under a pretext and vowing to myself, or, you may say, fantasizing, that one day, if ever the world turned an inch or two on its axis, I would seek him out and, for love of Tulip, provide him with a leg up in some undefined way that circumstance would determine. The rain was still pelting down as I got on my bike and headed not westward to France, but southward to Weimar. The last possible address I had for Gustav was 10 years old, a hamlet west of the city, a house registered in the name of his father, Lothar. After 2 hours' ride, I was standing on the doorstep of a dismal, Soviet-style slab house built 10 yards from the village church as an act of socialist aggression. The slabs were parting. Some of the windows were papered over from inside. Spray-paint swastikas adorned the crumbling porch. Quince's apartment was 8D. I pressed the bell to no avail. A door opened. A suspicious old woman looked me up and down. "Quince," she repeated in distaste. "Der Lothar. Längst tot. Long dead." "And Gustav," I asked, "the son?" "You mean the waiter?" she asked in contempt. The hotel was called the Elephant and overlooked Weimar's historic main square. It wasn't new. As a matter of fact, it had been Hitler's favourite hotel. The old woman had told me that too. But it had been dramatically refurbished, and its facade glistened like a beacon of Western prosperity shoved in the face of its poorer, beautiful neighbours. At the reception desk, a girl in a new black suit mistook my inquiry. "We have no Herr Quince staying in the house." Then she blushed and said, "Oh, you mean Gustav?" And told me that staff were forbidden to receive visits, and I must wait until Herr Quince came off duty. "When would that be?" "At 6 o'clock." "And best to wait where, please?" "At the delivery entrance. Where else?" The rain had not relented. The day was darkening. I stood at the delivery entrance as directed. A gaunt, unsmiling man who somehow looked older than his age emerged from a basement staircase, pulling on an old army raincoat with a hood. A bicycle was chained to the railing. He stooped to it and set to work undoing the padlock. "Herr Quince," I said. "Gustav?" His head rose until he stood his full height under the faltering light of an overhead street lamp. His shoulders were set in a premature stoop. The once red hair was sparse and turning grey. "What do you want?" "I was a friend of your mother's," I said. "You may remember me. We met on a beach in Bulgaria long ago. You sang me a song. And I gave him my work name. The same name I'd given him on the beach while his mother stood naked behind him." "You were a friend of my mother," he repeated, getting used to the idea. "That's what I said." "French?" "That's right." "She died." "I heard that. I'm very sorry." "I wondered if there was anything I could do for you." "I happened to have your address. I was in Weimar. It seemed an opportunity. Maybe we could have a drink together, talk about it." He stared at me. "Did you sleep with my mother?" "We were friends." "Then you slept with her," he said. As a matter of historical fact, his voice neither rising nor falling. "My mother was a whore. She betrayed the homeland. She betrayed the revolution. She betrayed the party. She betrayed my father. She sold herself to the English and she hanged herself. She was an enemy of the people, he explained. And, mounting his bicycle, he rode away. 11. I think the very first thing we should do, Hart, Tabitha is saying in her perennially diffident voice. You don't mind if I call you Hart, do you? I call all my best clients Hart. It reminds them that I've got one, just as they have, even if mine's necessarily on hold. So the first thing we do is make a hit list of all the disgraceful things the other side is saying about us. Then we knock them down one by one. Just so long as you're sitting comfortably, are you? Good. You're hearing me, aren't you? I never know whether those things work. Are they the National Health ones? French. Tabitha, so far as I remembered from my childhood reading of Beatrix Potter, was the harassed mother of three disobedient children. I was wryly amused, therefore, to note that, outwardly at least, the woman of the same name who sat before me shared many of her characteristics. Motherly, sweet-faced, 40-something, plump, a little breathless, and heroically tired. She was also, I had been given to understand, my defence lawyer. Leonard had supplied Bunny with the promised shortlist of names, names that Bunny admired hugely, would fight for you like absolute Rottweilers, Peter. And two that he was a teensy bit doubtful about, not sufficiently road-tested to his mind, but don't quote him, and one, entirely off the record, Peter, and you must protect me on this, that he wouldn't touch with a barge pole. Doesn't know when to stop, and not the haziest idea of how the courts work, and the judges absolutely detest her. That was Tabitha. I said she sounded just right for me, and asked to see her in her chambers. Bunny said her chambers weren't rated secure and offered me his headquarters in the bastion. I told him I didn't rate his headquarters secure. So here we are back in the library with the full-length figures of Hans Dieter Mundt and his arch-rival Joseph Fiedler scowling down on us. In time present, only one sleepless night has passed since we cremated Tulip. But the world that Tabitha is trying to come to grips with has taken an historic step backwards. The Berlin Wall has gone up. Every agent and sub-agent of the Mayflower Network has gone missing, been arrested, executed, or all three. Karl Remek, the heroic doctor of Köpenick, the network's accidental founder and its inspiration, has himself been mercilessly shot down while attempting to escape to West Berlin on his workman's bicycle. To Tabitha, these are facts of history. For those of us who endured them, they are a time of despair, bewilderment, and frustration. Is our agent Windfall for us or against us? From our redoubt in the stables, we, the indoctrinated few, had followed with awe his mercurial rise through the Stasi's ranks to his present position as head of its special operations wing. We had received, processed, and disseminated, under the generic title Windfall, highest quality intelligence on a raft of economic, political, and strategic targets to muted cries of delight from Whitehall customers. Yet for all Mundt's undoubted power, or maybe because of it, he had been unable to halt or even abate the relentless cull of covert agents and sub-agents as conducted by his rival, Joseph Fiedler. In this grisly duel for the favor of Moscow Center and command of the Stasi, Hans-Dieter Mundt, alias Source Windfall, claimed he had no option but to present himself as even more fervent than Fiedler in the business of cleansing the utopian German Democratic Republic of spies, saboteurs, and other lackeys of bourgeois imperialism. As one faithful agent after another fell to the competing fury of Mundt or his arch-rival, so the morale of the Windfall team sank to a new depth. And no one was more affected than Smiley himself, locked night after night in the middle room, with only the occasional visit from control to lower his spirits still further. Why can't I read the plaintiff's statements for myself? I asked Tabitha, the letters before action or whatever they are. because your former service, in its wisdom, has applied to slap a top-secret classification on all correspondence on the grounds of national security, and you're not cleared. They won't get away with this in a month of Sundays, but it will gum up the works and make way for a temporary reporting restriction, which is what they're after. Meanwhile, I've scrounged what scraps I can for you. Go? Where have Bunny and Laura disappeared to? I'm afraid they think they've got all they need, and Leonard has accepted their brief. I've had a first peek in the other side's locker. Unfortunately, poor Doris Gamp seems to have had the hots for you from the day she set eyes on you, and she couldn't wait to tell her sister Lottie all about you. And by the time Lottie had poured her heart out to the Stasi interrogators, there wasn't much left of you at all. Did you really scamper naked on the beach with her in the Bulgarian moonlight? No. Good. And there's a night of love and laughter you supposedly spent together in a Prague hotel where nature again took her course. It didn't. Good. Now to the other two deaths. Alec Limas and Elizabeth Gold are Berliners. Elizabeth first, as formulated against you by her daughter Karen. It's alleged that you personally contacted her, either on your own initiative or at the instigation of George Smiley and other conspirators unnamed, that you then inveigled, seduced, or otherwise obtained her to become human fodder. The other side's beastly expressions, not mine. In a abortive, grandiose, and ill-conceived attempt, who comes up with that stuff, I can't imagine, to undermine the Stasi leadership, did you? No. Good, you begin to see the picture. You're a professional Lothario hired by the British Secret Service, and you roped in susceptible girls as unwitting accomplices in harebrained operations that fell apart at the seams. True? Untrue. Of course it is. You also pimped Elizabeth Gold for your colleague Alec Limas, did you? No. Good. You also, because you do a lot of it, bedded Elizabeth Gold. Or if you didn't, you warmed her up for Alec. Did you do either of those things? No. I never for a moment thought you did. And the supposed end effect of your evil machinations, Elizabeth Gold is shot dead at the Berlin Wall, her lover Alec Limas tries to save her skin, or simply decides to die with her, either way he gets shot for his pains, and it's all your fault. Time for a cup of tea, or bomb on? Bomb on. Now to Christoph Limas's allegation, which is meatier because his father Alec is the victim of all that goes before. Alec, by the time you inveigled him, lured, bribed, conned, etc., into becoming the luckless plaything of your compulsively manipulative nature, was a broken man in no fit state to cross the road on his own, let alone front a fiendishly intricate deception operation, to wit, pretend to defect to the Stasi while actually remaining under your evil influence, true? No. Of course it isn't. So what I suggest is, with your permission, take a big pull of that water. Cast your beady eye over what I turned up in the wee hours of this morning when I was finally allowed a very limited look at a tiny part of your dear service's historical archive. Question one, does this episode mark the beginning of your friend Alec's decline? And question two, if it does, is it real decline or is it simulated decline? In other words, are we looking at stage one of Alec making himself insufferable to his own service and hugely attractive to Moscow centres or the Stasi's talent spotters? Circus telegram from H Station Berlin, McFadden, to H Joint Steering, copy to H Covert Ops, H Personal Most Urgent, 10th of July, 1960. Subject: immediate transfer of Alec Limas from Berlin Station on disciplinary grounds. At 0100 hours this morning, the following episode occurred at the Altes Fass nightclub in West Berlin between DH Berlin Station Alec Limas and Cy Aflon, DH CIA Station Berlin. The facts are not disputed by either party. The two men have a long-running enmity for which, as previously stated, I regard Limas as exclusively to blame. Limas entered the nightclub alone and headed for the Damen Gallery, a bar set aside for single women in search of custom. He had been drinking, but was not, in his own judgment, drunk. Aflon was seated with two female colleagues from his station, watching the cabaret and enjoying a quiet drink. Catching sight of Aflon and his party, Limas changed direction, walked over to their table and, leaning forward, addressed Aflon in low tones with the following words. Limas,
you ever try to buy one of my sources again, I'll break your fucking neck.
Aflon, whoa, Alec, whoa. Not in front of the ladies, if you don't mind. Limas,
$2,000 a month for the first bite of anything he gets before he sells it to us second hand. And you call that fighting a fucking war? Maybe gets a French kiss from these nice ladies thrown in.
As Aflon rose to his feet in protest at this flagrant insult, Limas struck him across the face with his right elbow, causing him to fall to the ground, then kicked him in the groin. West Berlin police were called, who summoned the U.S. military police. Aflon was delivered to the U.S. military hospital where he is presently recovering. Fortunately, no fractures or life-threatening injuries are as yet reported. I have submitted my abject apologies to Aflon personally and to his H-station, Milton Berger. This is the most recent of a series of regrettable incidents involving Limas. While I acknowledge that recent losses to the Mayflower Network have placed the station and Limas personally under considerable strain, this in no way justifies the damage he has done to our relations with our most important ally. Limas's anti-Americanism has long been apparent. It has now become totally unacceptable. Either he goes, or I do. And after Control's green scrawl, Smiley's lapidary reply. I have already ordered Alec back to London.
So, Peter, Tabitha is saying. Simulated? Not simulated? Are we looking at the official beginning of his downhill slide?
And when, in genuine doubt, I prevaricate, she offers her own answer.
Control certainly thought it was the beginning,
indicating the handwritten green scrawl at the bottom of the page.
Look at his footnote to your Uncle George. A very promising start, signed C. You can't get clearer than that, can you? Even in your murky world.
No, Tabitha, you can't. And murky it is, no question. It's a funeral. It's a wake. It's a thieves' conference held in desperation at dead of night in this very room, with Joseph Fiedler and Hans-Dieter Mundt staring down on us with the same lugubrious intensity. We are the six windfalls, as Connie Sachs, our latest recruit, has dubbed us, Control, Smiley, Jim Predo, Connie, myself, and Millie, our near-silent partner. Jim Predo is just returned from yet another undercover run, this time to Budapest, where he has brought off a rare treff with our most precious asset, Windfall. Connie Sachs, in her early 20s, already the unchallenged wunderkind of research into Soviet and satellite intelligence agencies, has recently flounced out of joint steering in a huff, straight into George's waiting arms. She is a brisk, chubby little body, blue stocking, born into the clover, and impatient of lesser minds like mine. Stately, remote, raven-haired Millie McCraig moves among us like a ministering nurse in a field hospital, handing out coffee and scotch to the needy. Control wants his usual foul green tea. Takes one peck at it, leaves the rest. Jim Predo chain-smokes his usual foul Russian cigarettes. And George? Looks so withdrawn, so unapproachable. Has an air of introspection so forbidding that it would take a brave man to interrupt his reverie. When Control speaks, he trails his tobacco-stained fingertips across his lips as if he is checking them for sores. He is silvery, dapper, ageless, and reportedly friendless. He has a wife somewhere, but according to the gossip, she thinks her husband's in the coal board. When he stands, his stooped shoulders come as a surprise. You wait for them to straighten, but they never do. He has been in the job since the mists of time. But I have spoken to him precisely twice and heard him lecture once, and that was on my pass-out day at Sarat. The voice is knife-thin like the man, nasal, monotonous, and irritable as a spoilt child's. And it doesn't warm naturally to questions,
not even his own. "So do we or do we not believe," he demands through his fluttering fingertips, "that we're still getting the best material out of Herr Bloody Munt? Is it second pickings? Is it chicken feed? Is it smoke? And is he leading us up the garden path, George?" With control, nobody uses cover names, house rule, doesn't care for them, says they glorify too much. Better to call a spade a bloody shovel than a holy relic. "Munt's product seems to be as good as it ever was, Control," Smiley replies. "Pity he didn't tip us off about the bloody wall then, or did he forget, Jim?" Jim Prideaux, after reluctantly taking the cigarette from his lips, "Munt says Moscow cut him out of the loop. They told Fiedler, they didn't tell Munt, and Fiedler kept it to himself." "The swine killed Remek, didn't he? That wasn't friendly. What made him do that?" "He just says he happened to get there an hour or two ahead of Fiedler," Prideaux replies in his habitually gruff monotone. And again we wait for Control, who, in return, lets us wait for him. "So we don't believe the opposition has turned Munt back on us," Control drones on irritably. "He's still ours. Well, he bloody well should be. We can toss him to the wolves any time we feel like it. He's power mad. He wants to be Moscow Center's golden boy. Well, we want him to be Moscow's golden boy, and our golden boy too, so our interests are mutual. But Herr Joseph Bloody Fiedler is blocking his way, and our way. Fiedler suspects Munt is ours, and he is, so Fiedler's out to expose him and claim the credit. That about the sum of it, George?"
"It would seem to be, Control."
"Seems to be. Everything seems. Nothing is. I thought we dealt in facts in this job. Yes or no? Herr Joseph Fiedler, a saintly man, we are told, by Stasi standards, a true believer in the cause and a Jew to boot, thinks that his esteemed colleague, Hans-Dieter Munt, unreformed Nazi, is the running dog of British intelligence, and he's not all wrong, is he?"
George glances at Jim Prideaux. Jim rubs his jaw and glares at the worn carpet.
Control again. "So do we believe Herr Munt? Another question. Or is he talking up a storm, same as a lot of other agents we know? Is he spinning you along, Jim? You agent runners are a soft lot where your Joes are concerned. Even a Class A shit like Munt gets the benefit of the doubt."
But Jim Prideaux, as Control well knows, is about as soft as flint.
"Munt's got people inside Fiedler's camp. He's told me who they are. He's listened to them. He knows Fiedler's out to get him. Fiedler has as good as told him so to his face. Fiedler has his own friends in Moscow Center too. Munt thinks they could make a move pretty soon."
Again we wait for Control, who decides after all that he needs to take a sip of cold green tea, and needs us to watch him do it too. "Which begs the question, doesn't it, George?" he complains wearily. "If Joseph Fiedler was out of the way, means to be discussed, might Moscow love Munt more? And if they do love him more, might we finally discover who the bugger is who is betraying our agents to Moscow Center?"
And receiving no answer from the company,
"How about you, Gwilym? Does youth have an answer to that question? I'm being relative."
"I'm afraid it doesn't, sir."
"Pity. George and I think we may have found an answer, you see, but George can't stomach it. Well, I can. I've arranged to see your friend Alec Limas tomorrow. Test the water with him. See what he feels about it all. Now he's lost his network to the Munt Fiedler Shooting Club. A fellow in his position might welcome a chance to finish his career on an up note, don't you agree?"
Tabitha is provoking me, I suspect deliberately.
"The trouble with you spies, nothing personal, is that none of you know the truth from your elbows, which does make it awfully hard to defend you. I'll give it my best endeavours, mind you, I always do."
And when I return her sweet smile but otherwise fail to respond, "Elizabeth Gold kept a diary, that's the trouble. And Doris Gamp told all to poor Lottie, her sister.
Women do these things. Gossip with each other, keep diaries, write silly letters. Bunny's lot are making hay with it all. They're comparing you with our modern undercover police informants who go about stealing the hearts of their women victims and giving them babies. I did take a peek at the dates to see if you could have given Elizabeth her Karen, but you're absolutely in the clear, which was a bit of a relief, frankly. And Gustav, thank God, is too old even to have been a twinkle in your eye.
It's a balmy autumn afternoon on Hampstead Heath, and 1 week after Control's announcement that he would be testing the water with Alec. I'm sitting with George Smiley at an outdoor table in the gardens of Kenwood House. It's a weekday, hardly a soul about. We could just as well have met in the stables, but George has managed to imply that our conversation is so private that we need the open air. He's wearing a Panama hat that blacks out his eyes, with the result that, just as I'm getting only part of the secret, I'm getting only part of George. We've done the small talk, or I assume we have. Am I happy in my work? I am, thank you. Have I got over the tulip thing? I have, thank you. Nice of Oliver Lakin to bury my draft. There was always a danger Joint would make too much of that mystery Swiss intruder at Camp 4. I say I'm glad too, although I sweated blood and tears over it. I want you to befriend a girl for me, Peter, Smiley confides, puckering his brow for greater earnestness. Then, realizing I might be misinterpreting this request, oh my goodness, not to accommodate any needs on my part, I assure you, strictly for operational purposes. Might you be willing to do that? In principle? For the good of the cause? Acquire her trust? The cause being Windfall, I suggest guardedly. Yes, entirely, solely, for the continued successful outcome of Operation Windfall, its preservation. As a necessary and urgent adjunct, he replies, and we sip our apple juice and watch the people come and go in the sunshine. Also, at the specific request of Control, I may add, he goes on, either as a further inducement or to pass the buck. He actually proposed your name. That young Gwillem fellow singled you out. Am I supposed to take this as a compliment? Or a veiled warning? George, I suspected, had never much liked Control, and Control didn't like anybody. I'm sure there are lots of ways of bumping into her, he goes on, looking on the bright side. She's a member of her local branch of the Communist Party, for one. Sells the Daily Worker at weekends. But I don't really see you buying a copy from her, do you? If you mean, do I think I come over as a natural Daily Worker reader, no, I don't think I do. No, no, and you mustn't try. Please don't, on any account, try to be someone who doesn't add up. Much better your usual genial middle-class self. She runs, he adds as an afterthought. Runs? Every morning early she runs. I find it charming, don't you? Fitness runs. Well-being runs. Round and round the local sports track, alone. Then off to work in a bookstore in Fulham. Not a bookshop, a store, but books for all that. Dispatching them to wholesalers in bulk. It may sound tedious to us, but she sees it as a cause. We must all have books, the huddled masses especially. And of course she marches, too. As well as runs. For peace, Peter. For peace, with a capital P. From Aldermaston to Trafalgar Square, then on to Hyde Park Corner for more of the same. If only peace was so easy. Is he expecting me to smile? I tried to. But I don't see you assisting her with a banner, either, of course I don't. You're a decent bourgeois fellow making his way in the world, a species quite unknown to her, and therefore all the more interesting. A good pair of running shoes and your puckish smile, you'll be friends in no time. And if you put on your French persona, you'll be able to make a graceful exit when the time comes. Then it will be all done and dusted. You can forget about her. And she about you, yes. It might be a help if I knew her name, I suggest. He thinks about this too. Painfully, problematically. Yes, well, they're immigrants. The family are. The parents are first generation, she's second. And they have settled, after some deliberation, on the name of Gold, he concedes, as if I have dragged the name out of him. First name Elizabeth, Liz to her friends. I too take my time. I'm drinking apple juice on a sunny afternoon with a tubby gentleman in a Panama hat. Nobody is hurrying. And when I've acquired her trust, as you put it, what do I do then? Why, you come and tell me, of course. He snaps, as if suddenly all the hesitation in him has been replaced by anger. I am a young French commercial traveller named Marcel Lafontaine, presently based in an Indian-owned boarding house in Hackney, East London, and I have the documents to prove it. It's day 5. Each morning, at crack of dawn, I take a bus to the Memorial Park and run. Most mornings there are 6 or 7 of us. We run. We stand panting on the sports hall steps. We check our times. We compare. We exchange a couple of words. Divide to the shower rooms. Say cheers and see you tomorrow, maybe. My companions are vaguely amused by my French name, but disappointed that I have no French accent. I explain that I had an English mother, now dead. In a cover story, kill off any loose thread before it gets out of hand. Of our 3 regular female runners, Liz, we have no surnames, is the tallest, but by no means the fastest. In truth, she's not much of a natural runner at all. She runs as an act of will, or self-discipline, or liberation. She is reserved and apparently unaware that she is beautiful, if in a tomboy sort of way. She's leggy, has dark hair cropped short, a wide brow and big brown vulnerable eyes. Yesterday we traded our first smiles. Busy day coming up, I ask. We're out on strike, she explains breathlessly. Got to be up the gates at 8. What gates are they then? Where I work, management's trying to sack our shop steward. Could go on for weeks. Then it's see you, till next time. And next time is tomorrow, which is Saturday, so apparently there's no picketing. People need to shop. We do a coffee together in the canteen. She asks me what I do. I explain I'm travelling for this French pharmaceutical company, selling products to local hospitals and GPs. She says that must be really interesting. I say, well, not really, because what I'd like to be doing is studying medicine. But my dad doesn't want me to do that because the company I represent is our family firm, and he wants me to learn it from the ground up and take it over. I show her my business card. My firm bears my fictitious father's name. She studies it with a frown and a smile, but the frown wins. You think that's right, do you? Like, socially? The son of a family inheriting the family firm just because he's the son. And I say, no, I don't think it's right. It bothers me. And it bothers my fiancée, too, which is why I want to be a doctor like her, because I admire my fiancée as well as love her. I think she's a real blessing to mankind. And the reason I've given myself a fiancée is because, although I find Liz disturbingly attractive, I'm never going to do another tulip as long as I live. It's also thanks to my mythical fiancée that Liz and I are able to walk beside the canal and earnestly swap our aspirations, now that she knows I'm lost in love and admiration for a woman doctor in France. When we have traded our hopes and dreams, we talk parents and how it is to be part foreign, and she asks me whether I'm Jewish, and I say no. Over a carafe of red wine at the Greek, she asks me whether I'm a communist, and instead of saying no again, I take the frivolous route and say that I just can't make up my mind whether to be a Bolshevik or a Menshevik. And can she please advise? And after that, we get serious, or she does, and we start talking about the Berlin Wall, which is so present in my mind that it never occurred to me that it might be in hers too. My dad says it's a barrier to keep the fascists out, she says. And I say, well, that's a view, I suppose, which annoys her. So what do you think it is, she demands. I just don't think the wall's there to keep people out, I say. I think it's more there to keep people in. To which I get the unanswerable reply, again delivered after earnest thought. Dad doesn't think like that, you see, Marcel. The fascists killed his family. That's good enough for Dad. Poor Liz's diary simply gushes about you, Peter, Tabitha is saying with her pitying, sweet smile.
You're such a gallant French gentleman. Your English is so good she keeps forgetting your French at all. If only there were more men like you in the world. You're a lost cause as far as the party's concerned, but you're a humanist. You know the true meaning of love, and with a bit of work you might see the light one day. She doesn't say she'd like to put arsenic in your fiancé's coffee, but she doesn't have to. She also took a photograph of you in case you've forgotten. This one. She borrowed her father's Polaroid camera specially.
I'm in my running gear, propped against a bit of railing, which was how she posed me, then told me to be natural, not to smile.
And I'm afraid it's in their submission too, Exhibit A, so to speak. You're the wicked Romeo who stole a poor girl's heart away and led her to the slaughter. There's practically a song about you.
We're friends, I announced to Smiley. Not over an apple juice on sunny Hampstead Heath this time, but back in the stables to the background putter of the cipher machine upstairs and the Windfall sisters at their manual typewriters. I tell him the rest of the operational intelligence. She lives with her parents, no brothers or sisters, doesn't go out, her parents quarrel, her father dickers between Zionism and communism, never misses synagogue or shirks a meeting of the comrades. Mother, determinedly secular. Dad wants Liz in the garment trade. Mum wants Liz to do teacher training. But I have a feeling that George knows all this already, for why else would he have chosen her in the first place? But what does Elizabeth want for herself, we wonder, he muses. She wants out, George, I reply more impatiently than I intend. Out in any stated direction, or just out for its own sake? Her best thing would be a library, I say. Maybe a Marxist library. There's one in Highgate she wrote to, but they didn't answer. She's already a volunteer at her local public library, I tell him, and she reads stories in English to immigrant kids who are still learning the language, but George probably knows that too. Then we must see what we can do for her, mustn't we? It would be helpful if you could remain alongside her for a little longer before you vanish to French shores. Are you comfortable with that? Not very. I don't think George is comfortable with it either. It's 5 days and 2 canal walks later, and night again at the stables. You might see if this appeals to her, George suggests, handing me a page ripped from a quarterly journal called Paranormal Gazette. You happened on it by chance in a doctor's waiting room while you were doing your pharmaceutical rounds. The pay is dismal, but I suspect she won't mind that too much. The Bayswater Library for Psychical Research is seeking an assistant librarian. Apply with photograph and handwritten curriculum vitae to Miss Eleonora Crail.
Marcel, I got it, Marcel, Liz is saying,
laughing and weeping as she waves the letter at me in the sports club canteen.
I got it, I got it. Dad says I should be ashamed of myself. It's bourgeois superstition gone mad and sure to be anti-Semitic. Mum says go for it is the first step on the ladder, so I've gone for it, starting first Monday of next month.
And when she's put down the letter, she jumps up and hugs me and tells me I'm the best pal she ever had. And not for the first time, I wish I hadn't invented that steady girlfriend waiting for me in France. And I think she's wishing it, too. It wasn't taking much to annoy me, as Tabitha was beginning to find out.
So as soon as you'd thrown your magic dust in her eyes, you ran off and told your friend Alec what a dear, nice communist girl you'd found for him, and all he had to do was get himself a job at the same kooky library, and the two of them would be in bed in no time. Is that how it worked?
There was no question of telling Alec anything. I had made contact with Liz Gold as part of Windfall. Alec wasn't Windfall cleared. Whatever happened between Alec and Liz once she'd got a job at the library was nothing to do with me, and I wasn't informed.
So your orders from Smiley regarding Alec Limas in his simulated decline to drink, dissolution and betrayal were what exactly?
To remain his friend and do whatever came naturally as things developed. Bearing in mind that as the operation advanced, my actions would be as liable to scrutiny by the opposition as Alex were.
So Control's instructions to Limas, meanwhile, would have been broadly this, correct me. We know you hate Americans, Alec, so go out there and hate them a bit more. We know you drink like a fish, so double the dose, and we know you like a fight when the drink's on you, so don't feel you've got to hold back, and while you're about it, just generally go to hell in a handcart. Does that about sum it up?
Alec was to trail his coat any way he thought best, that's all he told me.
All control told you.
What's she driving at? Who does she belong to, 1 minute coming within touching distance of the truth, then veering away as if it's about to burn her?